we trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about.
All right, so it's episode 28 of the In Tech We Trust podcast. And we're a little light on numbers today. So of the regular hosts, there's just myself and Mark. How are you, Mark?
Hey, I'm doing great, Nigel. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing good, actually, yeah.
You're still awake?
I am, yeah. I was kind of hoping we might record an hour early today, but that didn't work with your calendar, did it? So I've got the matchsticks in the eyes, and I'm trying to stay awake.
My apologies, Nigel.
No worries. Looking forward to it. It's British summertime next week, actually. The clocks go forward. And you know what? It's when spring comes and the clocks go forward, the whole world is a different place to me. I don't know about you.
Yeah, so what do you do with the extra hour of daylight?
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
No, what do you do? I mean, do you go out and run? Do you sow seeds in your garden? What happens?
Yeah, so I think like for the first month or two, it falls around the time that I'm putting the kids to bed. Great. But then after that, we've got a nice patio outside the kitchen. We can have barbecues. We can have friends around, stuff like that. It's pretty cool. You know what, as well, you probably don't have it so much in California when it's always sunny, at least compared to the UK. But, you know, in England, it's really dark and miserable during the winter. And then when it changes and the clocks go forward, there's just like, I get this, it's probably a mental thing, but I just feel like, man, a weight's lifted off your shoulders and everything's good.
Why do you ever go back? Why ever turn the clock back?
I know, yeah, do wonder that. But I'm pretty excited for today's show, actually, because we have a very special guest with us. So, Lauren Malhoit, thank you for being on the show.
Woo! Wow, thank you.
So, Lauren, can you do us a favor, and maybe our listeners as well, just in case some of them don't know who you are, can you just give us a quick rundown of who you are, where we can find you, your Twitter handle? Tell us a bit about your podcast as well, please.
Yeah, absolutely. So as Nigel said, I'm Lauren Malhoit. You can find me at Malhoit on Twitter. I am currently the co-host of a podcast called Size Matters Tech. We concentrate on IT in the SMB, the small to medium-sized businesses, with Jonathan Frappier, Shane Weinbrett, and Mike Stanley. It's still pretty new. I think we're only 6 or 7 episodes in, but going pretty well. So when you're not listening to In Tech We Trust, check that out.
I'll have to check that out. What's it called again?
Size Matters Tech.
Oh, hey now.
Hey. How are you finding it, by the way?
It's great. It's great. Yeah, I'm really enjoying doing it. I've done podcasts before, but only kind of a one-on-one interview fashion. And this is a group effort. And, you know, once in a while we have a guest on, but I really enjoy doing the group way, you know, much like you guys do.
Cool.
You know, Nigel, when you said, how do you find it? I thought you were asking, how do you search? I was going to say, size matters.
You don't want to put that into Google, I don't think.
We do get paired with some interesting podcasts on iTunes. So
I bet you do, yeah.
but we have a lot of disappointed listeners. Clean rating.
Yeah. Hey, so when you're not podcasting and when you're not on Twitter and the likes, who pays your monthly paycheck and what do you do for those guys?
Yeah, so I'm a contractor at Cisco. I work for the NCMA BU, which is basically ACI, Application-Centric Infrastructure, which is Cisco's SDN plus kind of solution, basically.
Wait a minute. I mean, I barely understand SDN. What's the plus all about?
So we're not just a network virtualization solution. We work with physical and network, and virtual layers. So we're able to manage the entire physical and virtual infrastructure basically from one controller. So that's kind of the SDN plus, whereas most of the other SDN solutions are not able. They mainly work with just the virtual environment.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's kind of the plus. It's basically built on the Nexus 9000 series switches. We do kind of a spine and leaf topology. And then we have a thing called the APIC, which is the Application Policy Infrastructure Controller, that comes off of it and acts as our controller. So, you know, most SDN solutions have a controller. That's ours. And it's, you know, of course, redundancy and all that good stuff. But basically, we manage the whole network through policy. We embrace the declarative model as opposed to the imperative model, which basically means, you know, the famous example is of the air traffic controller. We want to be the air traffic controller. We don't have to tell the pilot every instruction set to get the plane off the ground. We just have to tell the pilot to taxi over here and take off. And then, you know, the rest of it sorts itself out. So that's kind of how we treat our, you know, any layer 2 through 7 really device on the network. We tell it, well, we want the end game to be, and it does it.
Wow.
You know, Nigel, I don't know about you, but I think we're in trouble this week.
So you know what? I was so glad you gave that air traffic control analogy, because I was really wondering, was I possibly understanding less of that than Mark?
Oh, not possible.
Well, I've memorized it, yeah. So, you know, I barely know what it means myself. But
that was very good. We both really enjoyed that. I think we were messaging each other. It's like, wow, listen to her go.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, thank you. I'll tell my boss.
Well, thanks for being on the show with us, Lauren. Looking forward to it. Now, before we get on to tech news from this week, I want to pick up one thing that we didn't touch on last week's show. I think it was news from the previous week, but we had a busy show and we didn't get any chance to discuss it. VMware looked set to land this like mega 5-year deal with the US Armed Forces, worth something like $1.6 billion, only then to have it fall through on the same day that an appeal was logged by, I think, Amazon Web Services, Citrix, and Nutanix, of all people. But apparently the fact that the deal fell through or was postponed or whatever had nothing to do with the appeal that was lodged by AWS, Citrix, Amazon, Nutanix, and I think a few other little companies. Now,
if it didn't have anything to do with the appeal, what do you think happened?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a $1.6 billion deal, that's like massive, right? I don't know.
Yeah, my guess is they brought in the little containers of smelling salts and dropped them on the floor, and everybody kind of woke up.
Yeah, I mean, good grief.
Can you imagine the bill of materials for that? I mean, and maybe there wasn't enough substantiation to justify a spend like that. How do you do that?
There was all talk that it was going to save the U.S. government and the taxpayer money over that 5-year period.
Yeah, like Oracle saved the state of California.
Yeah, I bet. Yeah.
Well, that's how they were trying to justify ignoring all of the laws about what was free or the free economy and all of that good stuff too, right?
Yeah, so they were saying we're going to save so much money, so we don't mind sacrificing some free market principles here, which kind of sucks in my opinion. But when you think about it from like the VMware side of the deal as well, I mean, can you imagine how much effort was put into that RFP? How many trees were felled to print, you know, however many copies of it that had to go out, how many hours were spent by the sales and all the other teams involved in that, only for it to say, oh, yeah, we're postponing right now. Maybe we'll come back to it later. Because you know what? If they come back to it later, you're damn sure that they're going to have to pretty much start from scratch again.
There are a few salesmen crying themselves to sleep tonight.
Do you think
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and for probably months, right? Because it takes a long time to put those things through. So they tried to get something through and circumvent it and explain it as you know, the deal that can't be made again. And usually that's not the way it works. Doing business with the government here in any entity, you have to be able to show that you're selling the product for the lowest price that, you know, is available in the market and that kind of thing. And my guess is this deal just went by, you know, just blew past all of those rules, and somebody somewhere stopped it. My guess is that somebody in the process of purchasing in the government just said, "Whoa, wait a minute, this is way too much money for something that hasn't been through the procedure to add 30% to the cost of it."
Yeah. Hey, how do you think, because it was in the public domain that it was looking set that VMware was going to land this deal, and that kind of thing's got to have a positive effect on VMware's stock price. And then for that to change, because this is not just some 10, 20, 30, 40 million dollar deal. This is a big ass $1.6 billion deal to be expected and then to not happen. Does that have a knock on the share price?
Although we haven't seen it go up in the last several months.
So yeah.
I don't know if it truly did or not.
It can,
although if right? it did, that's sad, right? Because it would probably be much lower.
It can. If that number was factored in any way into expectations.
Yeah.
Right. And earnings calls or anything like that. Right. It's a big thing. So my guess is, though, that VMware had been fairly careful about, you know, and although, you know, talking about it in public, that's I don't know. It's possible.
Yeah.
It's possible it could hurt them. You know, I don't know when their next earnings call is. It's possible it could hurt them sometime then when they have to explain what's going on or. You know, if the deal's lost or something like that, right? Because there will be questions about it, I'm sure, at the earnings call.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's move on to tech news from this last week then. So I'll do what we did last week. I'll just run through quickly. I've got about four or five items by the looks of it. So first up, EMC announces the Federation Business Data Lake. We're going to come back and talk about that one for definite. There's also talk of Nutanix baking their own hypervisor. I think that's potentially interesting, so I'm kind of hoping we'll spend a bit of time on that one too. Amazon Web Services, they've started offering, check this out, 16 terabyte SSD-based EBS volumes. Stick that in your pipe and smoke it, okay? 16 Ooh. Terabytes of SSD.
Yeah. Amazing.
That is something. You know, Amazon Web Services, just coming off piste for a second, those guys continue to impress me. They always seem to be innovating and bringing new stuff out. I mean, they're a beast to try and keep up with. Anyway, so Joyent also announced something called Triton, products and services to deploy containers natively, either to the Joyent public cloud or to your own private cloud. I'm personally quite interested in that, but I'm not sure that we'll have a great amount of time to talk about it. Finally, though, Huawei this week released some spec SFS numbers for their OceanStor scale-out NAS product line. I think we're going to have a discussion around Huawei in general as a company and how viable they are in Western markets. So as far as we're concerned, that's the major news from this week. Now, let's look first at EMC announcing this Federation Business Data Lake. And I know, Mark, you've probably got one or two things to say on that.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. There's a number of, I think, large customers that are going to be real interested in this. What the tricky part is what the storage component is going to be in that data lake and what it's going to cost, right? The idea of data lakes is that you can have this big flat object storage space with relatively inexpensive storage in it, right? And you put pretty much everything in there and it becomes the equivalent of a soup or what's the plasma, right? It's like a data plasma and it's object based. So there's a lot of metadata in there and you use it differently than file data typically, right? Because you're accessing it with different metadata attributes and by its object name, as opposed to, you know, going through a path and a file system. I think it's got the potential to be very large, to be a very large business. It's involving Pivotal. That means it's got GE's backing in it and GE's involvement and probably, they'll be implementing it and talking about it. But I think it's a new way now to create all of this data then that you can harvest both for applications, you know, applications processing as well as analytics. We'll see how they really try to put these things together. I mean, when you think of data lake, you think primarily of analytics. New applications, though, writing object storage, are just going to use it as data. So it's very interesting, right? I think it's a whole new world for EMC, and it's got potential to open up a new market in a growing area, which is analytics. So interesting to watch. I think it was a very good play by them.
So I should probably have said this at the beginning. I'll come to you in a second, Lauren.
No worries.
So it's a hardware and a software offering, as far as I understand. And the three people behind it, I think you suggested there, Mark, EMC, VMware, and Pivotal. And they're aiming essentially to do big data at scale. Now, what I liked about it, okay, was they seem to be offering services to help customers get up and running, right, with this. Because, I don't know, I think a lot of customers would like to get involved with this, but see it as a big step up to be able to actually deploy and then do all of this fancy analytics stuff. So they're offering things like proof of value and onboarding services, which, you know, is kind of holding your hand to customers and saying, hey, buy our solution. And I'm sure it's not the cheapest out there, right? but we wrap it with all these services and things. We'll make it easy for you to get on there. And then once you're on there, we are going to sting you for pre-. No, I'm the last bit.
Yeah. They're going to sting him with the services price.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
I mean, EMC is always good at figuring out how to make money, and this is another example of it. I think that they will be creating value for their customers, you know, and it's really interesting. You look at what they did with VMware, and then you look at what they did with Pivotal. And for a while, I've been thinking about Pivotal as just like this strange company that became the place where they threw a bunch of other, you know, technology
misfits.
Into it. Say, here, yeah, misfits here. Here's the misfits, Paul. Go manage them. You know, Paul Moritz's misfits, right? But but now this is coming together, and you know, so you've got the potential and I think realization of an analytics business with all the software that Paul and his team have been working on, you know, with the virtual infrastructure that VMware offers, and then EMC is going to have to figure out how to provide cost-effective storage for this. That's the hardest part, I think, in all of this, is figuring out how they're going to sell storage cheap enough at the volumes that customers want to buy.
I guess my concern is around the complexities of the different types of data and how they're actually analyzing it. I mean, it's not all one type of analysis. Every different company is going to use it in a different way. So how are they going to do that? I mean, how are they going to offer services that do that properly? You know, how does that all work? And I know nothing about big data, but that's where I was, I don't know, kind of stuck.
Well, they'll do it business unit by business unit. It's a big services opportunity, right? So, you know, a large company, let's say it's an engineering company, you know, someplace that makes semiconductor chips, right? And there's somebody working on a project for low power chips or something like that. And, you know, they'll have data that they buy externally and they'll have data that they generate internally. And that will all go into this data lake, and they'll be able to find it somewhat by the metadata that's associated to this stuff. Then EMC and, well, there's this consortium, you know, will sell services to say, okay, now we've got this data out here. Let's try to figure out how to parse it, distribute it, and then we'll start massaging it and working with it to see what we find. And they'll start generating examples of how to look at it and see if any interesting things comes up, right? Because analytics is really about trying to find the combination of things that you didn't expect. So it's always a search. It's always an experiment. It's always like, we don't know where we're going, but we're going to find our way as we go. And so, you know, this consortium, the EMC, I don't know what I need to call it, something other than a consortium, but the Federation. Yeah, the Federation. Thanks. Yeah. So the Federation will go in and try to help these people understand how to do these discoveries initially, and then, you know, they'll have their own data scientists and figure out what they can do for other organizations, other products, that kind of thing. I think the idea of the services is to sort of build out a template for success with analytics with this data lake.
Mm-hmm. So the two things that spring out to me, right, the first one is that they're offering a proof of value service, which to me suggests at least that they have confidence that they can go into these different organizations and they can generate some value. Because at the end of the day, the whole idea behind a proof of value is if there ain't no value delivered at the end of it, they take the kit away and it's, let's look at the next project, right? The second thing I've absolutely forgotten. So,
well, the first one's good enough. You think about the second one. Can I talk about the first one?
Yeah, go for it.
I mean, this is what was so important about having GE be part of Pivotal in the first place. GE probably, you know, one of the world leaders in analytics for industrial processes, right? And so they have been working very closely trying to figure out how to do this stuff. And my guess is that they've been having some amount of success. And now they're getting ready to go out and say, okay, we're confident enough that we can have success that we'll be able to do it in our customers also. They've been developing the data science practice to allow them to have the confidence to do this.
Yep. All right. I remembered my thing. It was a question, actually. Do we expect that customers will ever have their own data scientists on staff? So all I'm thinking is, right, so originally you buy in services, right, and they land crazy data scientists for you that help you find some value out of your big data that you've got sitting around, right? Then at some point, generally speaking, you want to, as a customer, be able to move yourself away from being reliant on the vendor and their professional services and things like that and have your own guys. Do we expect that run-of-the-mill companies going forward will have data scientists on staff?
if a company has a DBA, why wouldn't they have a data scientist in, you know, 5 or 6 years?
All right. Fair enough. Okay, so shall we move on to what I think is next of interest? Nutanix, right? We've given these guys a fair bit of airtime recently. They really seem to be trying to play with the big boys. So I think last week we talked about they had some kind of new Uber Nutanix certification that they were saying is up there with the CCIE and the VCDX. And I know that Gabriel and Hans didn't really respect them for that, thought, who do these guys think they are? Well, again, this week they're talking, or there is talk in the news, that they're baking their own hypervisor. And my initial reaction was that Gabriel and Hans are going to roll their eyes at this. But the more and more I thought about it, I thought, you know what? This kind of makes sense for them, right? So at the moment, they offer this hyper-converged solution, right, that's based off either VMware or Hyper-V. But having to do it that way, a slice of your cake, you're always having to give to either VMware or Hyper-V. They're always going to take their slice, you know, from your profits. So it just, maybe it feels a natural next step for them to say, you know what, let's cut these guys out. We're big enough, we've got enough of a name, we've got enough market share now where we can deploy our own hypervisor, and then everything that comes in is gravy. You know, it's all just for us and we don't have to start sharing it out with other people. Now, don't get me wrong, right? Writing your own hypervisor is no mean feat, but if they could pull it off, that would be a good move for them.
I think it's a really interesting play for them. There was speculation that it's more for maybe a smaller outfit, an SMB. I think that's pretty cool, especially if the price point matches it. Because right now it is a little expensive for some of the smaller companies. And, you know, VMware can be complex depending on how you're doing it. So a simplified kind of lighter hypervisor could be a really great play, I think, in an SMB arena.
I'm not sure how hard it is to write a hypervisor.
I imagine it's quite hard. I mean, I appreciate it's not necessarily a fully fledged operating system, okay? But all of it, well, at least in my opinion, it's all of the core, really important stuff. All of, you still got to get the memory management right, all the process scheduling, all of that kind of deep, low-level stuff that I'm sure it's all written in C these days, but I imagine is like written in like assembler code and stuff like that. You know, stuff that you don't want to get wrong. Okay, so it might be a small trimmed-down version of an operating system without all the bells and whistles, but you know what? It's core infrastructure at the end of the day, and you don't write that overnight and not put it through, like, arduous testing, surely.
Oh, absolutely, but you know, think how many years ago was it that people already said, you know, the virtualization game is not about the hypervisor anymore. There's just not enough complexity to the hypervisor. You can't add that much more value at the hypervisor level. You add the value, uh-huh, you know, in other ways, right? So I think, you know, I think Intel makes it a lot easier for people to write hypervisors, for instance.
Oh, no doubt, yeah.
You know, so I'm not, I think probably the hard stuff about figuring out how to make hypervisors work has already been learned by the people that have done it, and that knowledge is available. That knowledge of how to do that is out there in the market, and it can be hired. You know, there are consultants and specialists and employees and all that stuff that Nutanix can bring in and pay a lot of money to get the job done. I think it's a brilliant move on their part. To your point exactly, why pay these guys? You know, and to Lauren's point, if it can cost less and more people can adopt it, why not? Right?
Oh, yeah.
It's a big economic advantage. And if there really is, and then the proof will be in the pudding, right? It'll be interesting to watch. If Nutanix is successful doing this, then it's going to just, you know, everybody's going to know there is no difference between hypervisors. You could argue one way or another, you know, how they're managed, but, you know, basically, yeah, it's all the same thing.
Yeah. You know, I just thought while you were talking there, Mark, I wonder though, right, would their hypervisor have to natively support VMware virtual machines and potentially Hyper-V virtual machines as well, rather than just their own standard or an open standard? You know, to be able to get customers on board, it would surely ease that step. You know, you come in, right, you're Nutanix, and you say, we can offer you a VMware-based solution, a Hyper-V-based solution, or if you want to, you know, have a solution that's just as good but cheaper, we'll throw our own hypervisor in there. But that seems, for me as a customer, right, I'd think, okay, I'm going to save some money, but it's a bit scary, right? It's a hypervisor I've never heard of. And what about my existing virtual machines and things? I wonder, and I'm only wondering here, right, whether they're thinking, is this going to be a hypervisor that natively supports VMware guests and Hyper-V guests? And if they do that, then, you know, do we start to lose functionality and features that we would normally get from VMware and Hyper-V? I don't know. It's interesting. It'll be a good one to follow, I think.
Yeah, to Lauren's point, too, before, she was talking about the fact that it'd probably be a good solution in the SMB space. It probably would. And it may be easier to get the product in there just because of less concern about, you know, compatibility in the big wide world of everything they already have. It's probably easier to do it in a small greenfield environment than a large crowded one. What do you think, Lauren?
Well, yeah, why not run, you know, everything? If you have part of your environment on whatever they're going to call their hypervisor, and maybe more production on VMware, maybe that changes, you know, given the time of year or whatever, you know, whatever reason those things change. Why not be able to run both?
Yeah.
Yeah, fair enough. Okay. So I don't particularly want to go into a lot of detail on the Joyent story and their Triton for native containers into the cloud. But what I did think was interesting, right? So apparently Joyent have their own operating system come hypervisor as well called SmartOS. And it's, so bear with me here, right? So apparently it's based on OpenSolaris. It runs like ZFS and all that kind of cool stuff. But then it runs Solaris zones. And within a Solaris zone, you can run Docker containers. I mean, if that's not turtles all the way down, then I don't know what. But the moral of the story here, right, apparently by using this SmartOS, instead of being 100% like Linux shop or something like that, this has enabled them to deliver this infrastructure now where they're going to be offering containers on effectively bare metal rather than virtual machines. So giving, I guess, Joyent the ability there to cut the virtual machine out of the equation. And if you remember, the virtual machine's got quite a lot of fat in there. So if they're up against another cloud provider offering container services, but their competition is, you know, landing containers on top of virtual machines, here we go. Joyent will potentially get greater densities, and all because they went with their own custom operating system. So you know what? For Nutanix going forward, maybe they'll even be able to get tighter integration and all that kind of jazz. The technologist in me here thinks that this Nutanix story here is going to be, if it does turn out to be true, it's going to be a cracking one to follow.
Well, one thing about Nutanix is they haven't had a lot of their own intellectual property, right? Their business
That's
is
a cracking
based on,
point, yeah.
Their business has been based around integrating all these parts together, and it's astounding how fast they've grown and how they've been able. I mean, I think that company's done a great job going a long distance and getting huge investments without defensible IP.
Yeah, right? And you know what? Anytime you have a conversation with anybody about Nutanix IPO, right, they always say they don't have enough IP to have value. So, yeah, there's a lot of aspects to this, actually, isn't there?
Yeah.
I like that.
So getting back to Joyent, I think that's, I mean, what you talk about, said with Joyent is really interesting. I mean, do you think that will matter to customers? Do you think customers will go to Joyent because of that?
So it's really interesting. I don't really know who I think Joyent compete with. I'm guessing like DigitalOcean and people like that. But do they look to compete with Amazon Web Services and Microsoft Azure as well? Because I don't know whether this would turn somebody away from AWS and Azure, because they have all, you know, well, especially AWS, just they've got so many different services out there. But if I was looking for a cloud-based hosted container service, I would definitely look at Joyent. I mean, I play in that space a little bit anyway, right? But because of that, I know a bit about Joyent, and these guys are hardcore into Docker and containers and all that kind of stuff. I'm not surprised that they've come so quickly to market with a service like this. So if I was a business and I was looking to deploy containers to the cloud, definitely I'd be looking at somebody like Joyent, and a technology like this would make me have at least a double take towards them and look a little bit closer. And you know what? If it does let them get greater densities out of all of their physical servers that they've got, that's possibly going to be passed on to customers in lower cost as well, right?
Well, I would think it would be passed on in faster iterations of software, right? I can see DevOps people really going for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if it's a little bit too soon, you know, for its own good. Like in 5 years, it'll be an awesome feature that everyone looks for. But right now, I don't know that the market is there yet.
I think you could be right there. You know what it felt like, or what Joyent feels like a little bit to me, and I don't want to be harsh on them here, but reminds me a little bit of Rackspace and OpenStack.
It does, yeah.
Really love what Rackspace have done and you know, do with OpenStack. They just can't compete with AWS and all the other people out there. It's just, as a public cloud and basing it on OpenStack and all the commits they make and all that kind of stuff, love it as a technologist. But, man, they are fighting a big old battle there. And let's not forget, at AWS reInvent, Amazon were talking about their own container service, ECS, I think they called it. So it's not like those guys aren't gunning for the same thing here. Love what Joyent are doing, and I hope they make a success of it. But, hell, it's a big old dogfight they've got.
They do. They have to fight it some way. So it's great to see them fighting a good fight.
Yeah. Now, let's move on to Huawei, okay? I'm going to confess, right? I haven't even looked at the spec SFS numbers. Don't really care about them. I am interested in what you guys think, though, about Huawei as a viable business in the Western markets. So let me just back that up, okay? We're talking here about a Chinese-based storage company in this aspect, right? Who, I don't know, are they tarnished by being Chinese? Hell, I mean, everything's made in China anyway, right? But you don't seem to be able to have a conversation about Huawei without somebody saying, well, they're passing information back to the Chinese government and stuff like that. Don't get me wrong here, okay? I have no evidence to that. I'm just saying you can't barely have a conversation about them without somebody saying, oh, you want to steer clear there.
Yeah, that was my only thing. I mean, I don't know much about Huawei, admittedly. But every time I hear it, yeah, I think about, what was it, 2 years ago, the scandalous, you know, news reports that were coming out every other day about them. So that's kind of, I don't know. But maybe, I'm just thinking like an American, you know, maybe in the Western or the Eastern world, you know, it's not, they'll take off.
Yeah, I mean, I don't doubt they will outside of the West. But as big as China itself is, as a country and as an economy, you know, the US is still the big market that everybody wants to tackle, right? And I guess potentially Europe as well. I don't know, maybe they need a rebranding or something like that to try and, as much as I hate that kind of crap, but you're totally right. You know, we always do think of those stories that were a couple of years ago or whatever they were now. That kind of mud sticks.
Yeah, it does. But just today, it was interesting. In the UK, there's some board at is it Oxford or something? They were given a clean bill of health by some UK security board, right?
Oh,
just
right.
Today. Yeah, I'm reading this right now. It happened, you know, like the news was 7 hours ago.
Yeah.
They apparently set up an independent cybersecurity evaluation center in Oxford. They did this in 2010 in conjunction with the British government to check whether its equipment could pose a threat to national security.
What, for Huawei specifically or just generally?
For Huawei specifically.
No way.
Yeah.
And they've given them the clean bill of health after 5 years of potential investigation?
Yes.
There you go.
Yeah, the quote here says, any risks to UK national security from Huawei's involvement in the UK's critical networks have been sufficiently mitigated, it said. I wonder if it means that the CIA can, you know, tap into their stuff.
Yeah. Hey, Mark, no, that's a really good point, actually. Something I'd wanted to mention on last week's show, but I forgot to, was that in the previous week, there'd been a story about Cisco shipping boxes to dummy addresses. You probably can't comment on this, Lauren, I don't know. to some of their sensitive customers, right? So instead of sending it to sensitive customer, they send it to a dummy address. And then it gets forwarded on, or the customer comes and picks it up from there. The whole idea being trying to avoid the NSA or the CIA bugging these devices. And apparently, it's quite a popular practice for these sensitive customers. And word is, Cisco even has customers that are so paranoid about boxes being backdoored and what have you. Bit of a dodgy term, actually. Yeah, that they
hey
have,
now.
Yeah,
they have sorry, some, can I take that back too? Yeah.
they have some customers apparently drive up to the warehouse to collect kit themselves. They're so paranoid about stuff being tapped by the government.
Kind of like going to the Mercedes factory in, you know, Bavaria or whatever.
Yeah.
BMW factory in Bavaria to pick up your car.
Well,
go to the Cisco factory to pick up your switch.
I mean, I get that, you know, you have like a nice new Merc or Audi or something and you're all excited to get it. You want to drive it home. I don't know that people get particularly the same kind of excitement about Cisco boxes. Maybe they do. Do they, Lauren?
People come in all different shapes and sizes.
there are
those out there that get real excited.
Yeah, and security people, you know, they have to get their jollies some way. So
that's true. Yeah, I'm glad I'm not a security guy if that's how you get your jollies.
You feel real important.
So maybe we'll have drones flying all over now. We'll have direct ship from Cisco warehouse. You know, they'll be dropped by helicopter off some big plane somewhere, and then people will come and snag the parachutes, you know, and take them away on drones. So they can't get in the hands of CIA.
I can see it already. Yeah.
Amazon just got clearance to start testing drones, didn't they, in certain places?
I think they did. So now we have Huawei getting clearance, Amazon getting clearance for drones. It's a brave new world.
The world is changing, isn't it?
It is.
Hey, on the flip side, is China a viable market for US companies and for Western companies at the moment, do we think?
You know, I mean, we're kind of dealing with that, and it's a tough market, for sure.
I know it's hard in publishing. How many books have you sold there, Nigel?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, I think I've only sold about 10 in total, so probably none.
Oh, man. People need to buy Nigel's book.
Yeah. No.
You know, it's interesting. American companies, I think, have been successfully selling in China for quite a while. There are some industries that are easier than others. I think it's, you know, software is a tough one, right? It's software's tough. Microsoft has complained bitterly about it for many years. Because of pirating. Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of companies that have done very well in China. I'm trying to come up with an example. Like, for instance, I don't know how Red Hat does in China.
Yeah, I mean, again, another software company. Well, you know what? I don't know that they do particularly well. I'm speaking Linux in general here, because you would think that China would be a ripe market for something like Linux, where you don't have to pay licensing fees. Now, I'm talking, you know, on the desktop and stuff like that. But coming back to the Microsoft thing, apparently they're like massive users of Windows over there because they just pirate it. I've got to think Microsoft would struggle, wouldn't they, as a software company without, you know, real strict protection around intellectual property.
That's correct. And there's been a lot of lobbying and, you know, communications at high levels of government about just that very thing, because it impacts the U.S. software industry, you know, to some degree. I think Microsoft's probably been the torchbearer for that, but my guess is Oracle's, you know, next in line.
Yeah. Hey, Mark, I think here's a company that's successful in China, Apple.
Yeah. They are.
I mean, I remember when the latest version of the iPhone came out. I don't follow Apple. I can't even remember what number it is. But there was word that, you know, that top end of the Chinese market, because my initial thought was, well, how many people in China can afford a high-end phone like an iPhone? Well, it turns out, apparently, that small slice of the Chinese population is actually greater than the population of the United States.
Wow. The small slice that isn't actually making the phone.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, they have so much buying power over there. There are some U.S. cars that I think surprisingly are doing very well in China. I might be wrong about this, but I think I heard that Buick was one of them, of all companies, right?
Buick. Isn't that like an old man's car?
It is.
Buick doing well here? Because I can't tell you the last time I saw a Buick.
I know, but, you know, you see ads for it, and they're trying hard. You know, their ads here are selling their cars trying to say that they don't look ugly anymore. They're selling their new cars based on the fact that their old cars were ugly. It's just unbelievable.
You know what?
Talk about rebranding.
Well, yeah. I've had EMC sales guys come in the past. When VNX2 was announced, true story, they come in and they show us all these awesome PowerPoint slides of this is how we're now leveraging the multi-core processors that we've had in VNX for years, right? Look at this, how well, you know, all the workload is balanced across all the cores. And look at how bad it was in VNX1. And I'm sitting there on top of a bunch of VNX1s in my estate thinking, are you really saying this to me as a customer? Yeah.
Apparently so. Yeah. Thanks for being a sucker.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. My boss is sat there and I'm like, oh, great. Right, shall we switch on to business news then? Couple of interesting items then. We've got Brian Pawlowski, Mr. Flash, 20-year NetApp veteran, leaving NetApp for pastures new. He's gone to join all of that EMC talent that's been bleeding out to Pure Storage. Very interesting story in my opinion. But also we've got a new backup player emerges from stealth with $10 million worth of funding behind it. That's what are those guys called? Remind me there, Mark. Is it Rubrik?
Yeah. Yeah.
So my eyes roll anytime I think about the backup and recovery space, but apparently not this time, right? These guys are going to be ending a decade-long innovation drought in backup and recovery. Shame Rick's not on the show.
Oh, yeah, that's deep water there. Who says, what's the 10-year drought? I mean, has there really been a 10-year drought?
How did we go from, all physical to doing virtual backup and recovery? I mean, that was a totally different technology, certainly within the last 10 years. Some of the features they mention with, the mounting points and just constant on-demand recovery, those things already exist. Being able to, whip up a dev environment from your current environment. I mean, Veeam does all those, and so do half of the other, at least virtualization backup players in the game.
You need to pick up the phone to their CEO and tell him that then.
Well, it wasn't an article I was reading from them, so I guess I can't tell them that. But
was it Mark's article you're reading? Because Mark, I know that you've just put out an article. Do you want to say something about this?
Well, I had a blog post today, yeah. And I mean, there's a bunch of things that strike me about what Rubrik is doing. Now, it's a different podcast, right? I was a guest on Speaking at Tech a few weeks ago, and I sort of got dragged through the mud, for killing backup or killing backup.
Oh, yeah,
software,
I did hear it, yeah.
There was that whole thing because I wrote this book, when I was a Store Simple Microsoft called Rethinking Enterprise Storage. And the second chapter in there is called Leapfrogging Backup with Cloud Snapshots. And my old cronies at Microsoft have been publishing chapters of this book online and blogs at Microsoft. And Simon Sharwood picked up on one of the things that I said. And he had this quote in one of his posts that said, if cloud storage had existed decades ago, it's unlikely that the industry would have developed the backup processes that are commonly used today. That's something that I wrote in the context of writing about Store Simple.
Yeah.
He read it in the context of Microsoft wanting to kill backup.
Ugh.
Right. So it was an interesting thing. Yeah. And, as I explained in my blog post, it got all twisted around, the context was lost. But I actually do believe that if we had had cloud storage many, many years ago, we wouldn't be backing up to tape the way we are. People would be doing it a different way. They'd have figured out how to use the cloud more effectively. So Store Simple did that to some degree, and it was primary storage merged with cloud storage. We call it a cloud integrated storage. And now you see Rubrik coming out, and I don't know if Rubrik is going to be cloud-based, not cloud-based, but, use the cloud extensively. It could be object storage, probably both. And they're saying that they're going to take care. They're going to use new technologies to take care of backup once and for all, so you don't have to have this horrendous mess of software and tapes and dedupe and best practices and all this stuff that takes forever to work through. And I think they've got a shot at it, right? They've got a shot at proving that it can be done differently, but it's going to be tough because you have to undress people's best practices and get them to not do things that they used to.
Well, here's my question, too. I read that it's really only applicable to VMware environments right now, or will be, in the first iteration, which is fine.
Well, that's interesting. I didn't read that. That's interesting.
I guess I don't know for sure, but that's
No, that's I'm sure you're right. You read it, yeah. So I'm...
From Duncan Epping at Yellow Bricks, I read that. But, enterprises aren't just VMware either, so I'm wondering, how we're killing backup, but, when 30 to 40% of our environment's still hardware,
Yeah, you've got to start somewhere, though, don't you?
Sure, and yep, absolutely.
I think VMware makes technical sense, and if you're going to start somewhere, just because it does have so much of the market, I mean, everybody tends to have a VMware-first approach when they come to market, don't they? So, interesting. I mean, I do think backup and recovery is just not a sexy thing, right? And... It just isn't. And if they can make change and be disruptive there, it's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, think about this, though, right? If you've got a connection to the cloud, why would you ever write anything to tape? I mean, I don't know why you would, right? So as new data comes in, you can protect that. You can make a copy in the cloud. You create metadata to know where it is, how to get it back, how to restore it, how many copies to keep, all of that kind of stuff. I mean, why would you ever do anything to tape? Well, you would use tape because you need the speed and because your bandwidth isn't big enough to go to the cloud, and things like that. But otherwise, you can automate this whole process and get rid of all the manual stuff and the stuff that likes to break.
As long as you're doing cloud correctly, right?
Yep. Yeah, I mean, I think if you've got a connection to the cloud, generally speaking, right, wouldn't you back up initially to disk and have that? Because don't most restores come from like the first 24, 48 hours? So if you can keep, let's say, 2 weeks worth of on disk, on premises, right, and then trickle it off to the cloud after that, you hardly ever have to pull it back. Do you even then need tape?
Well, you don't, but you do need DR coverage.
Which yes.
Right. So you keep copies on hand in snapshots, and then you have snapshots in the cloud also, which then just become, copies. It's at some point the data gets old enough, it's not being used. You just blow away the local snapshot, the local copy or whatever, and you've got the copy or, multiple copies in the cloud because cloud storage service providers are always keeping multiples. Right.
I believe that's how they were saying doing it too, creating policies for whatever you want, and then after a while it goes off premises into some sort of cloud option, right?
Yeah, you still have you have to cover the hard part is you have to cover offsite as well as on-site speed. So you need the speed, but you also need the DR. And automating the DR stuff to the cloud remotely is just, it's a slam dunk. Trying to figure out how to do it the right way to do it, the kinds of products. I mean, I really mean that when I said if we had the cloud a long time ago, would we have all these tape courier trucks running around taking tapes everywhere? The answer is no.
Yeah.
It probably costs more than cloud to do that too. Iron Mountain.
Yeah. Hey, Mark, so have you just killed tape there as well?
Yeah.
You have, haven't you?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, tape is still the lowest cost option for a lot of storage. If you can make tape look like disk of all things, right? There's a lot of ways that can really work. I'm trying to think who's the company with the Black Pearl product? Spectralogic. Spectralogic has, a bunch of tape that looks like disk, right? And they cache the file system view on a disk or that sort of thing. And if you really want low cost storage, for long term storage of stuff, that Black Pearl product looks awfully appealing. And it's not disk, it's tape.
Hey, Mark, you mentioned your blog earlier. Just a quick off-topic question. Your blog's called Data on Top, yeah?
Yes.
Did you get any grief from NetApp when you named it? Because obviously it's very similar to Data on Tap.
It was so small, I got no attention, nobody cared. Alex McDonald gave me a little bit of grief, but he wasn't an official, a barrister or anything.
Yeah, okay. Speaking of that, actually, should we switch on to Mr. Flash Ray jumping ship from NetApp to Pure Storage? I'm wondering here, is this a kick in the nuts for NetApp's whole play around Flash? Does the market react to something like this? So, high-profile guy, leaves, he had a prominent position within the Flash and the Mars product. He leaves to go for an uber competitor in Pure Storage. Does the market care? And when I say the market there, I mean, does NetApp's investors care? Does the share price care? But do potential customers take notice of stuff like this as well?
Some might, but not very many.
Yeah, I don't think it really matters where different, vendor employees go. It's always looking for the better deal, right? It's not really a big F you to the product that they're in charge of,
Okay, and do you think the better deal, generally speaking, is cash and health benefits and stock and stuff like that? Or do you think it's a better deal as in, hey, we're working with a better, more nimble company, we've got better technology? Is it a technology thing? Does he believe more in Pure's product line? Or do you think stuff like this, and I don't mean this case in particular, but generally, do you think it comes down to cash?
It's both.
Yeah, the cynic in me wants to say cash, but yeah, I don't think you go to like a shitty company, just because they're giving you more money. But if you believe in the new company, then why not do it, right?
Yeah. Hey, what's the general perception of NetApp for you two guys at the moment?
For me, it seems like they have had some trouble moving forward, kind of keeping up with the new storage technology. So, if this FlashRay stuff isn't working out, then obviously that could be an issue for them, but uh-huh. that's kind of, I don't have a ton of experience with NetApp though either, so.
The blood's in the water, the sharks are circling, the feeding frenzy is going to be going on NetApp accounts all over the world. Everybody else that sells storage is going to be selling into NetApp accounts. This business, the storage business, always feeds on where it thinks there's weakness. NetApp is perceived as being weak, and everybody is going to try to sell into NetApp accounts. They've got a real dogfight on their hands.
And do we think
or that shark it's... fight. Shark fight on their
hands. Yeah. Do we think it's because they've held on to ONTAP for so long and the guys that engineered ONTAP and what have you are so powerful within the organization that they've almost resisted change?
I think they went from being a company that saw themselves as being an innovator to a company that saw themselves as being financially sound.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, it went from Wormenhoven to Georgians, and I really think there's a dividing line there. I think Wormenhoven had a different approach and a different approach to running the business than Georgians has.
You know what? To me, they're almost the opposite of EMC. It seems to me, right, that EMC are totally all about reinventing themselves and tackling new challenges and wanting to get new products and into new markets and things. And NetApp, they just seem like it's on tap all the time. It's such a shame.
Well, you can lay some of that at Wormenhoven's feet also, right? I mean, Tucci did an amazing job reinventing EMC by buying all these various companies, right?
Yeah.
And when he bought them, they ran them basically as separate business units. They didn't try to integrate them all together.
Right.
You know, NetApp buys Spinnaker, and then they try to integrate everything all together, and then nothing happens. I mean, in terms of M&A, EMC outdoes most other companies, and they've badly outdone NetApp.
Oh, absolutely. They have, yeah.
I mean, look at this Federation Business Data Lake stuff that we're talking about earlier, right? It's amazing, right? They buy all this stuff. They spin it out. They turn it into Pivotal. And the next thing, you know, here it comes back as a whole new opportunity in a high-growth market because of companies they bought. They didn't know what to do with. You know, they gave him the Maritz to put together, and he did what appears to be a wonderful job doing it. Just, I mean, it's some of it's good luck, and some of it is, I think, just amazing vision.
Yeah, Maritz's misfits, yeah?
Knocking it out of the park.
Taking the world by storm. One last question, maybe. On this same NetApp story here, okay, Pure Storage are obviously making waves, right? They've got a ton of cash behind them and what have you. I went to visit them in California, the first storage field day event that happened. And I don't know what it was, like 4, maybe 5 years ago now. And then I went to see them again like a year ago. And to me, it seemed like the same story. I really felt like they hadn't innovated in the meantime. They had a cracking product, don't get me wrong, and they're winning customers left, right, and center. Happy about that. I'm just wondering, you know, are talent acquisitions like this potentially fueling internal expansion of product lines and internal innovation again within somebody like Pure? Because even, you know, a company like Pure, who are an all-flash storage array company, and that's a growing market and all of that stuff, they've still got to innovate. They can't stand still, right? Are we expecting Pure to be expanding and innovating still?
Like you say, they better.
Yeah, I sure hope so. Because, you know, we see what happens when you don't.
Okay. Anything for anything else, guys?
I just want to say one thing. I mean, when Pivotal first was spun out, I thought it was a joke. I thought it was stupid. You know, I was wrong.
Yeah.
No one really knew what it was going to be, right?
Yeah, I just thought it was a garbage bag.
Well, yeah, it wasn't doing well at VMware when it was all one, so they just spun out the things that weren't working.
I just thought, you know, they bought, really, EMC and VMware were buying these companies, and I thought, it's just that, you know, they don't know what else to do with them. They threw them at Pivotal, mm-hmm. You know, and I just thought it was ridiculous. I was wrong.
Yeah, fair play to you for holding your hand up there as well. I do wonder whether it's maybe as much of a surprise to them as well that it might be coming good. But we also, you know, we mentioned Maritz's misfits, okay. Let's be careful here as well. We're just saying misfits as in VMware and EMC probably didn't know where to position them within the respective organizations. We're obviously talking very, very talented, scary, scary, clever people here, right?
Right, yeah.
So, yeah, again, kudos to EMC there. If this really does take off, this federated or federation business data lake, whatever they're calling it, that does take off. Well done to them. Hats off there.
Agreed.
And on that note, guys, thanks for being on the show, Mark. Lauren, thank you again for being on. It's been cracking.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Anytime one of the other slackers on your podcast can't make it, let me know.
We got slackers. So we do. That Rickatron, he's never on. I think you should come on full-time for Rickatron. Rickatron, if you're listening.
No, we love Rickatron.
We do, but I mean, he's got to show up.
He does occasionally, yeah.
I could represent the Midwest for him when he can't be there.
You can, yeah. Actually, yeah. And you know what? You fill a bit of a hole for us when it comes to networking potentially in the future as well. So we have talked in the past about maybe having a bit of a network corner on the show once a month or something like that to cover for the fact that between the five of us, we could barely plug a cable in. So
I have a hard time believing that. But okay.
Yeah, we may take you up on your offer.
Besides, once a month, we want to say size matters.
Hey.
That's right.
Cool. And I think on that note, we will slide out. Thanks again for listening, everybody, and join us again next week.